I'm Andrew Saul, Commissioner of Social Security. Beware of telephone scammers pretending to be government employees. Real Social Security employees will never threaten you. Callers threatening you with arrest or other legal action and demanding money are not from us. If you receive a call like this, hang up, do not provide them with any form of payment or information, report the call at oig.ssa.gov.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling I don't want to know. It's all the streets you crossed not so long ago. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs program from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium. An apocalypse is an event on a grand scale, a catastrophe that affects our lives indelibly. It is also a story that, judging from the sheer volume of them that we tell, alone and together, has a definite ending, the details of which we are rather concerned with. What is it about the current day that so often casts our focus onto apocalypse and the events that follow it? Is there a background noise of sublime terror, a raging storm, or news of permanent collapse pervading our lives, driving political conflict, justifying ever greater engineering of social order? And is this disaster specific to us, or has it always been present throughout the ages? In first seeking the center of the apocalypse, I sat down with Ben Knight, a Berlin-based filmmaker, and asked him about the movie he just made.
Okay, so it is called We're All Going to Die, and it is about people who are preparing in one way or another for catastrophe. And it kind of moves through different types of preparation. So it begins with your standard prepper type person who would be like hoarding food and maybe learning new skills and figuring out how to, you know, use radios again and rather than cell phones, and then all the, yeah, just preppers, and then sort of talking about how they their kind of disappointment with the way everyone else is just carrying on their day, and they have to think about all these terrible things that are going to happen. So that's the kind of the beginning of it. Anyway, so I met a couple of preppers, and then it kind of moves into a more climate change, climate grief is a big thing now amongst a lot of people, and it has been for quite a while. And I met a couple of people in the States who went through a profound grief 20 years ago, because they felt like this economic and social system was totally unsustainable. And so there was this, he's called Guy McPherson. He went and 20 years ago, he felt like, you know, this isn't going to work. No. And he went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico. He was a tenured professor, and he gave up his job and went and lived on a homestead in New Mexico and learned how to make cheese. And then he realized that there was another thing that meant that even if somehow humans prevented the burning of fossil fuels overheating the earth, because of what he calls the aerosol dimming effect, the pollution would actually shields us from the worst heat of the sun. So even if we reduced pollution, we would be fried too. So he then realized that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, and decided that he couldn't be bothered to live on a homestead anymore, and now he just lives in a normal house and gives interviews and does podcasts and things like that. And he calls himself an educator. I mean, he's like an odd fellow, because he kind of, what was interesting about him for me was because he went through this period of profound despair and grief, and what he thought was that the futility of trying to continue. And then he came out of the other side of it and said, well, look, you know, we're all going to die, so there's nothing anyone else could do about it. So I might as well just live the best life I can the way I want to live and not worry about anything. And that's what he does now. Do I feel that daily life has given over to chaos? No, I feel like what is surprising about the current situation is that everyone is carrying on as normal and basically shutting out the chaos as much as they can, and finding ways to distract each other. I mean, there's always like an initial shock moment, as it happened when, especially if you live in Europe, when Russia just invaded Ukraine, for example. But then after a few days, and, you know, we have like hundreds of thousands of refugees, you started noticing that people were posting their Wordle scores on Twitter again, which they had been doing, you know, quite regularly up until that moment. And then there was about a week where people stopped doing it, and then they kind of put them back. So I think there's a natural human tendency to avoid chaos at all costs. If people get used to things, don't they? It's surprising how quickly people get used to disaster scenarios and learn to cope. I mean, just to get back to the same example again, but I was reading reports now of people in Kiev, and how, you know, they want to open the schools again in Kiev tomorrow. They want to do online schooling again, which is like crazy when you think about, you know, that the Russian army is 20, 25 kilometers away from the city center still. Well, first thing was that someone told me that they were going to go to Mexico anyway. And I thought, oh, that would be cool to go to Mexico. And then I remembered that in Mexico, it's the site of the center of the Chicxulub crater, which is the crater that was caused by the asteroid that killed all the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And I kind of thought it would be, you know, what better place to sort of conclude the film, but at the site of a catastrophe that almost wiped out all life on Earth, and one of the five great big mass extinction events that have happened, the last one that has happened throughout in our history. And so I had this sort of vision of filming at this, because I knew there was a little monument there. There's a little memorial to the dinosaurs in this town, and it's a town on the northern coast of Yucatan, on the Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula, a sort of coastal town. But the crater itself is 100 miles across, so you obviously can't see it, and it is also about a kilometer underground. And they only really found out that it was there in the 1980s. And so, yeah, I just thought I'd, but then when they did find it, the little town, and it's a kind of like a, there's nothing really in the town. It's like a beach resort, but not a particularly fancy one. There are no big hotels there, but they do have a little monument to the dinosaurs, which I thought was quite poignant. So I wanted to film there. And so I did a little thing where I stood next to the monument and spoke to the camera about my feelings about why I wanted to film a scene there, and why, you know, why I saw that point as a kind of the starting point for the film, even though it was right at the end of filming. Yeah, so that was one reason. Oh, the other thing was that there's a lot of Mayan people still around there, and people often think of the Mayan civilization as a civilization that collapsed. So I was quite interested in that too. So I interviewed a few Mayan people. I mean, most of the people in that region are still have Mayan heritage. So that was pretty interesting. And rather than a cycle, I would think of it as concentric circles that we're always kind of living in a space that has been created by a past disaster, that we are never really, the destruction of all the dinosaurs was what was the event that made our evolution possible. You know, I mean, it's getting a bit, like, obviously a bit esoteric now, but the idea is that we're always living in the aftermath of another disaster, and that disaster is what made our lives even possible. So I want people to kind of make peace with the idea of apocalypse, make peace with the idea of collapse and destruction, because after all, our own lives depend on someone else's apocalypse and other creatures' extinction, you know. And so I kind of like, I see it as sort of, yeah, like we're always, we're always inside the crater of an asteroid that crushed the people that came before us, or the dinosaurs that came before us. A lot of people feel a lot of anxiety at the moment, and especially now because of the war. But also because of a lot of people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, and a lot of people feel general anxiety about, you know, pandemics. People just worry about the future. It's part of our nature to worry about the future, and people want to feel safe, and none of us really are ever safe, and something like the threat of nuclear war kind of really brings that home. You know, I meet an Indian author who's written quite a lot about climate change called Amitav Ghosh, and then he kind of says, well, what's interesting for me about all this is that it's not like I don't worry about the future either, because for my part of the world, he comes from Bangladesh and India, and people from the colonized parts of the world, they've already been through their own destructive apocalypse, and now they're still alive, you know, and they still survive and they still thrive in many ways. And he says that what he sees is basically this anxiety about the future is a kind of is just like our part of the world, the Western part of the world, realizing that it is losing its power. You know, like apparently in grief, like when psychologists talk about grief, there's a thing where if you've got a parent or a grandparent who is dying, and you know that they're going to die, people start to grieve in advance, you know, or especially if they have dementia, you can see them, like, their faculties shutting down one by one, and people who are watching their loved ones die like that, they go through this kind of pre-grief, and there are these therapists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say that this is what a lot of people are feeling now about the earth itself or about the society itself. They're feeling this kind of, they're going through this kind of pre-grief for something that is dying. But yeah, there's a nostalgia, there's a loss. We've lost our innocence, and in a weird way, they kind of want the apocalypse to happen so that we regain that innocence. You know, it's kind of it's a very Christian thing, isn't it? It's like we gave up paradise, so now we have to somehow get back to it through a major disaster. And that would it would be like a purge. It would be like Noah's flood, and then we would get back to our lost innocence. I think a lot of people would say that but probably that's not how it'll pan out, because as you say, we will have certain technologies that we could probably still use for a while anyway. I mean, yeah, depends how long your generator's going to run. I mean, a lot of the preppers that I know are actually, even though they don't believe in climate change, or the ones that I met didn't, they actually hate the Green Party and the Green movement in general. They actually are quite ecologically better prepared than most people, because they have invested in solar panels, because they do think that the power grid is not sustainable. So they have invested in having local solar panels, which is this one guy I know in, I'm thinking of this guy I know in Cologne, who's extremely skeptical of the climate movement, but he is autonomous from the power grid. Mm-hmm. I think it would be like the idea that hope is treacherous. I think a lot of these people look at the way that normal people, but everyone feels like that we have to everyone is like hoping that, you know, like Putin doesn't launch his nuclear weapons, or hoping that we prevent the worst excesses of climate change, or hoping that that you know, society won't collapse, and that we'll find some way, we'll keep it together in one way or another. And they see this hope as a delusional thing. And he said, and one guy McPherson, in fact, he said, I said to him, but surely because he wrote in one of his books, he wrote like, we should give up hope. Like, hope is this treacherous thing. And I said, but surely the opposite of hope is despair, you know, surely. And he goes, no, he was like, if he would have slapped his thigh if he could have done, but he was like, no, it's not why are you saying that? You know, that's not true at all. And then I said, okay, so what is the opposite of hope? And he said, I say, the opposite of hope is taking action, is a sort of taking responsibility for your life, or trying to change something. If you really, really do worry about these things, if you are extremely anxious about the future, then hope isn't going to help you. What's going to help you is figuring out how you are going to deal with it and facing it. And I suppose that's what stuck with me, was this sort of, and that can be practical. It can be like, you know, do what a prepper does and find a bunker in the forest and fill it with food, or it can be, you know, joining a climate protest or something. It can be like whatever you do, it can, or it can just be facing up to this, your general anxiety, and figuring out, okay. Because we are all going to die, so what are you going to do with the time you have left? You know, what is valuable to you? And I think that is sort of the profound thing, is that, you know, we should, like this idea that, yeah, this idea that it will all be okay in the end, is a treacherous idea, and in fact, it should be okay now, and all you can really control is this is how you cope with your life. What we're facing is, everybody goes, oh, we're all going to die, yeah, but then we are all going to die. Like, that's the one immutable fact of human existence is that it will end, you know. And fully realizing that is, I think it's an Achilles in Homer. Doesn't he say everything is more beautiful because we're doomed, and the gods envy us for our mortality, you know, like, didn't he say something like that? For so sure. I think the idea of it is that, you know, we can everything is more beautiful because we're all going to die, you know, because of our mortality, and the gods envy us, the immortal gods envy us because of that. So I guess it's so what I'm saying is that this sort of fear of the apocalypse is actually just a facing up to the sort of the human condition, in a very normal way, because, you know, yeah.
A man who has made a more specific, a metaphysical study of apocalypse, through how life should be lived at all times and in all places, is Orthodox rabbinical figure Chad Whitaker of Pittsburgh. I put him to the question in a dark cavern.
People are constantly bringing some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario to bear to, as like an exercise in like some sort of existential threat. And, okay. And perhaps the closer we get to feeling that there's some sort of accelerando in our lifetimes, it was wars in the past, and now obviously what we're looking at is...
Yeah, more wars, even like heightened. It is a crescendo. Maybe, but here's the thing. All right, so fundamentally, I don't know, right? Like, fundamentally, I don't know. Right. Like, logically, I can picture some scenarios. It's like, I can imagine an existential threat materializing. Like, I can imagine more easily now than last month, right? Like, a nuclear holocaust materializing, right? Or I can imagine an existential threat not materializing and universal paperclips and, like, you know, humanity expanding out into the galaxy or whatever, right? Like, you know, I can imagine Isaac Asimov, Last Story, sort of like cyclic, like, you know, the boom and bust and the, like, the on universal scales and, like, all of this, right? Like, anything logically imaginable is imaginable, okay? And God's outside of all of it, and God's doing whatever he wants, and there's these fundamental patterns of ordering, of hierarchy, of structure, you know, of structures of beauty, of these abstractions, of these hierarchical structures, like those are kind of circling back around to like this little apocalypse. Like, I really only need to care about what's in front of me. What's, like, what's in my sphere of influence, you know? Well, how about everything else? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm not everything else. Right. Like, I'm me, right. You know? Like, here's what I have to deal with right in front of me.
In terms of that existential threat, though, I think we're always presented with some extraordinarily grim, dark, bleak, like the road, or Nathan was talking about the stand earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I guess just like, what do we do in the face of that? What do we do, you know, rationally with a study of history, with a study of, you know, you have this theological framework.
But man, we had apocalypse in the last century. Like, look at Russia last century, you know? Like, look at the utter upheaval of mm-hmm. civilization and, like, you know, the Communist Revolution and Stalin. And yeah. The gulag, and like,
yeah,
you know, which is like reverberating through to our present day, right? Like this, like these tumultuous, yeah, you know, or the, like the Polish Jew, right? Like the, like Holocaust, like they're, like we witnessed in the 20th century, you know, almost as much apocalypse as one could want, let's say, you know, short of an existential crisis, short of an existential threat materializing. It's like these were, and then, but then what do individual people do in these, right? Like, there's a book called Father Arseny. There's a biography of this priest named Father Arseny, you know, who was an amazing saint in the gulag, and like kept the flame alive, you know, like it was like a real life. Well, you referenced the road, right? And like that's fiction, okay? Like keeping the light alive, like gotta keep the light alive. Like this guy kept the light alive in the gulag for decades, you know? And like when you're a person, you know, like
right.
When you're a person, like he couldn't he wasn't in control of the sweep of history, you know. He wasn't. he's a grain of sand in the ground in the wheels of history, right? And what? And he did well with what he had, you know. And like, what more could any of us hope to do than to do well with what's God has given us in our sphere of influence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, raise your son as well as you can. Love your neighbors as well as you can. Like, I don't want to do it out of fear. If I'm going to prepare for an apocalypse, like, there's, like, the apocalypse, choosing not to try to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I tasted choosing not to try, and that is what terrifies me. That's what terrifies me.
I'm telling myself the story of my life, Stranger and Song of Fiction. We start with the joyful mysteries before the appearance of ether, trying to capture the elusive. The farm where the crippled horses heal, the woods where autumn is reversed, and the longing for bliss in the arms of some beloved from the past. I said, "Your daddy loves you." I said, "Your daddy loves you very much. He just doesn't want to live with us anymore."
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
A social distancing tip.
Putting distance between yourself and others is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus. So here are ways to stay in contact without the physical contact part. Call, send a text, set up a video conference, post on social media, dedicate a song on the radio. If you have symptoms of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, call your healthcare provider before going to their office. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all #AloneTogether. Brought to you by the Ag.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Ready for Whiskey Before Breakfast? I am. I'm Mando Richard. Thanks so much for tuning in to Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. We've got a great show today. We'll start off like we always do on the liquored up side of the family. We'll close down actually with a little bit of an extended gospel set. And in between, we'll hear lots of different kinds of music that I know you will enjoy. Well, let's get our liquored up set started, shall we? Wayne Scott's going to tell us that it's the whiskey that eases the pain.
Rock
bottom, you may not be on the ground. Let me tell you something in case you're walking with the cane. It ain't love, it ain't money, it's a whiskey that eases the pain. Eve told Adam that she had apples for sale. He bought the first one, I bought the last one, what the hell. If you're needing a crutch, don't try to walk with the cane. It ain't love, it ain't money, it's a whiskey that eases the pain. It ain't love, it ain't money that makes this world turn around. When you hit rock bottom, you may not be on the ground. Let me tell you something in case you're walking with the cane. It ain't love, it ain't money, it's a whiskey that eases the pain.
Wait, or can I get you now? I must hesitate. doctor's son, that I can do the doctor till the doctor comes. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Or can I get you now? Or must I hesitate? Shoes, I believe, my Lord, I got the hesitation blues. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Or can I get you now? Or do I hesitate? If the river was whiskey and I was a duck, dive to the bottom and I never come up. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Or can I get you now? I must have hesitate. Or can I get you now? I must have hesitate.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
I'm Joe Rollin Porter. Get out your breathalyzers because you are listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with Mando Richard. Richard, blow into this, please.
last thing I remember, I was sipping Ricky Rose. I was talking about loving you, baby, from your head down to your toe. I'm afraid to say I made the wrong impression. Let me set the story straight and make a small confession. There was a wine talking. There was a wine talking. There was a wine talking. Baby, that was me. I can drink Crown Royal and even have a double. But when I switch to Ricky Road, that's when I take a tumble.
You can drink gin all night or champagne with its bubbles. But when you switch to grape, that's when you get in trouble. Wasn't my intention, but there were some other things that I forgot to mention, like three little boys at home who never give me peace, and they look just like their daddy, who's the chief of police.
Now there's a couple things you need to know about my life. I've been married 7 times, now I got a jealous wife. If she finds out we got down last night, you can be damn sure there's gonna be a fight. That's me, baby, some vintage Oscar Wilson.
Uh-huh.
What year was you born, honey?
1979.
Mmm, that was a good year for beautiful women.
You sound like a connoisseur.
Yes, indeed. You might say that. You are full-bodied yet delicate and refined, and with just a hint of bodaciousness.
Is that good?
Oh, girl, I'll drink you right up.
There was a wine talking. There was a wine talking. There was a wine talking. Baby, that wasn't me. There was a wine talking.
Oh, honey, no, I wasn't.
There was a wine talking.
Well, it could have been.
There was a wine talking.
Mandolinist Butch Baldessari and lap dulcimer player David Schnaufer are giving us Drunken Hiccups as a musical bed here, and that's from their 2006 record, Appalachian Mandolin and Dulcimer. Upset. There we go. Wayne Scott got things started with It's the Whiskey That Eases the Pain from his 2006 release This Weary Way. Then Jim Watson. Jim Watson, where have you heard that name? Why, he was with Red Clay Ramblers, and he often tours with Robin and Linda Williams. Jim Watson gave us If the River Was Whiskey and I Was a Duck, and that's from his 2001 record, Willie's Redemption. Then after the PSA, Amos Milburn gave us Bad, Bad Whiskey. And I played that from that compilation, Cheap Old Wine and Whiskey, that I've been known to feature from time to time. And the last thing was from the blues side of the family. The Cashbox Kings, joined by Shamika Copeland, doing the Wine Talkin'. And that's from the Cashbox Kings 2019 record, Hail to the Kings. Before Breakfast originates from the studios of WRCT Pittsburgh, so how could I not play Leon Morris singing Walking Home to Pittsburgh?
Flew to Nashville first class and was all alone. Didn't have the money to pay my way back home. The change in my pockets don't add up to a dime. Now I'm walking home third class, making shoe leather line. Semi-tires on concrete shore makes a lonesome sound. They can't pick up riders, but I'm still covering ground. Can't afford the bus fare, too weak to hop a train. Walking home to Pittsburgh, 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 to those steel mills again. Walking down the highway, soaked by freezing rain. Awful cold and hungry, I barely know my name. Long hard miles behind me and a whole lot more to go. I'll make it home by Monday if the Lord holds back the snow. Semi-tires on concrete shore makes a lonesome sound. They can't pick up riders, but I'm still covering ground. Can't afford the bus fare, too weak to hop a train. Walking home to Pittsburgh, 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 to those steel mills again. State trooper checked my papers and he asked me where I'm from. He had a nice warm heater, my hands and feet were numb. I guess someday they'll find me stoned from an overload. Walking home to Pittsburgh, somewhere's along the road. Semi-tires on concrete shore makes a lonesome sound. They can't pick up riders, but I'm still covering ground. Can't afford the bus fare, too weak to hop a train.
walking home to Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh,
Pittsburgh, to those steel mills again. Walking home to Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh,
Pittsburgh, to those steel mills again. Walking home to Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh,
Pittsburgh.
You think after years of just giving it all, while playing your heart out and no curtain call, after large fame and fortune just passes on by, you'd think any rounder would kiss it goodbye. But a few days at home and I'm back in the grind, dead, broken, ornery, half out of my mind, till a call comes in from some old slick I once knew. So I pack up my guitar and shine up my shoes.
On a lonesome old highway and a weary old road, my two-lane companion who shoulders the load. Won't you take me right back where I come from before? Weary old highway.
Take me back,
take me down home.
Never quite there, or packing it out in the cold midnight air. It's not for the glamour of living alone in a thousand cheap hotels we get to call home. But it's call time at Sharky's on a Saturday night, when the air is electric and the music is tight. It's choosing a pathway that's always been there, with a good tuning guitar I've made it, I swear.
On a lonesome old highway in a weary old road, my two-lane companion who shoulders the load. Won't you take me right back where I come from before? Some old highway and a weary old road, my two-lane companion who shoulders the load. Won't you take me right back where I come from before? Weary old highway,
take me back,
take me down home once more.
Weary old highway.
Of your brain. I'm replacing the guides with a reason, and I don't wear shoes. I measure shadows. I'm changing my mind like the seasons. And before I was Socrates, I was a guy named Bob. I worked all day at the Sunset Lounge, and I thought I knew wrong from right. I thought I knew right from wrong. But when Pericles died, I was weeping, because some things are beyond my control. And when babies are born and the world spins around, can tell there's too much I don't know. I am Socrates. Know thyself before you're someone else.
edge of defeat. Now, yes, I am a ship off to conquer the night. And I thought I knew right from wrong. I thought I knew wrong from right. So I'll be brave when I am drinking the hemlock, because I think that I have played a good card. I put out to the world this question: just what is the greatest reward? Know thyself before your someone else. So well, so well. Life is sweet.
I stood on the white strand, and you were everywhere. Vivid memories fade, but the mood still remains. I wish I and then